related procedures, and whether they lead to isolated or related results. These issues will feature also in this understanding of human beings, because there will be the whole business of emergent probability in human affairs as well. So if you're tired of the first five chapters, just realize that some of this is going to become applicable to questions that may be more interesting to a number of you than these particular questions might be. That is to some, and people have different interests as they read this book. And some would be more interested in these chapters than others. But the material here carries over into the understanding of human beings. There are schemes of recurrence in human affairs as well, and probabilities of insight and decision and so on that will influence his understanding of human affairs. Anyway, the answer to the question of whether they're isolated or related procedures falls into three parts. The first part, classical and statistical investigations are complementary as types of knowing, and that's numbers 2 to 9 on the notes that I gave you. The second part, there is also a complementarity in the to be known, and a worldview implied by this twofold complementarity, the view that Lonergan calls emergent probability. And that's numbers 10 to 24 on these notes. And finally, in chapter 4, this worldview of emergent probability is contrasted with the worldviews of Aristotle, Galileo, Darwin, and determinists. In the class, we will not cover section 3 in any detail. We just don't have the time for it. But I will make a couple of points there with regard to the difference between Lonergan's worldview and Galileo's, because it influences the question of mechanist determinism, which is one of the scientific elements that he was attempting to address in this book. All right, so first then, numbers 2 to 9, the complementarity in the knowing. And this breaks down into a number of different issues. And the first of those issues, I'm just going to take them point by point, just as he puts them in the book, and pause wherever there are questions. But the first thing is there's a complementarity in the heuristic anticipations, the anticipations of insight. Now, I think really this first complementarity, I think you need the next one together with it before they become complementary. I think the first one is just an either-or, and either-ors are not necessarily complementary. But at any rate, what he says about it, the relations between data must be either systematic or non-systematic, one or the other. It follows that in any given case, either the classical or the statistical anticipation must be correct. So in any case, it's going to be one or the other. There are two corollaries of this. First of all, empirical method, scientific method, is open. It does not determine in advance whether any range of data should be reduced to system or should be shown to diverge concretely and non-systematically from system. Secondly, empirical scientific method is a matter of trial and error. The only way to work it out, the only way to figure out whether you're dealing with systematic or non-systematic process, is to formulate both hypotheses, work out their implications, and test the implications against the observed results. So it's an openness to the scientific method. Nothing is determined a priori, either system or non-system. Next, as I said, I think you need this one to go together with the first one before you see that these are complementary. There's a complementarity in the procedures. The two types of investigation separate two different kinds of data that are systematically related and data that are non-systematically related. And the isolation of either one allows for the determination of the other. Now, that's where you get into a complementarity. When you isolate one, you're able to do something with the other, and vice versa. Now you're into a complementarity between the two of them. So you can separate, either physically or mentally, two different kinds of data or two different sets of relations among the data, those that are systematic and those that are non-systematic. So physically, for instance, in a laboratory, a physicist might isolate a definable conjunction of elements that he or she knows are systematically related to one another, and isolate those so that they're not influenced by extraneous factors. And then from there, you can work out the laws that obtain under these conditions of other things being equal and no extraneous factors coming in to influence your procedures. Or mentally, you may invoke known laws to seek the determination of the unknown, the whole business of the heuristic anticipation. Well, we know this, we know this, we know this. and so we can move towards, so we know A, B, C, we can move from that towards the determination of D. Now, that separation, whether it's either physical or mental, is not confined to classical laws. The examples that he gave up to this point are the separation of the systematic, separating it from extraneous factors. But one may also invoke laws of probable errors and so eliminate a non-systematic component in observations and measurements. And here, this I think is something that an example that I found helpful. Or one can explain non-systematic macroscopic phenomena by the statistical combination of classically conceived genes. And that is a good example, I think, of how in the known there's a complementarity. All right, the Mendel's laws there, what he really came up with was the statistical combination of genes conceived classically. So you've got the two working together there. The genes are understood according to classical laws, but they combine statistically. And different combinations of different people or animals or whatever. Moreover, knowledge of statistical laws enables one to separate mentally the non-systematic component in the data, and so it leaves one free to investigate the remaining systematic component. So it's just that if you can isolate one, you can work with the other, and vice versa. And so there is that complementarity in the procedures. Is it clear up to this point? He's just trying to show how these two work together. They're not isolated forms of knowing, but rather related forms of knowing. Chris?
Is it safe to say that also data always includes both components?
Yes, and that's going to come up in one of the next, one of the things. Is it under the, I'm not sure if it's in section one or section two. Number 8 on the next page. So that all data, there's something classical and something statistical about all that. Is that the point you're trying to make?
Yeah.
So we'll see that when we get there. In fact, I think that's really the clearest instance of the complementarity. Okay, next then, classical and statistical formulations are complementary. So the classical formulations, it will give you a mathematical formulation for a law, the law of falling bodies, the distance is proportional to the time squared. That regards conjugates. Remember now, conjugates are correlatives that are defined in terms of their relations to one another. So here you've got distance and time defined in terms of their relations to one another. Distance is correlated with time in a particular way, and that correlation defines both of them. Two terms related and defined by their relations. So classical formulations regard conjugates, but conjugates are verified only in events. The law of falling bodies isn't an abstraction. It's verified in events. It happens. It happens that bodies fall in this particular way and according to this particular set of laws. In a vacuum, yes, but nonetheless, it happens. Okay? And statistical formulations regard events which are defined only by conjugates. There's no such thing as a pure happening. There's always something that happens. And the something is defined in terms of conjugates, correlatives, whatever it is that happens. You don't just have an event. Okay. Again, classical laws tell what would happen if conditions were fulfilled. Bodies would fall like this under these particular conditions. Statistical laws tell how often those conditions. So the phrase, other things being equal, which strictly speaking should be added to every classical anticipation, that phrase amounts to a vague reference to the statistical residues, what's left over, the non-systematic departures, which are the province of the complementary statistical laws. Other things being equal refers to any relevant pattern of a diverging series of conditions. Again, there's the inverse dependence of statistical upon classical formulations. If statistical formulations are to be significant contributions to the advance of science, they will appeal to the experiential and pure conjugates of classical classifications and definitions. In other words, you can do statistics on all kinds of things, but only some of them are really going to be scientifically significant. He gave there for instance, the probability of a trombone player having red hair. It really is probably not very scientific. In other words, the conjugates define whether the statistics have any real scientific significance or not. Inversely, the conjugates of classical formulations are verifiable only in statistically occurring events, and their imminence in statistical residues is revealed by the proviso other things being equal. Except, I think we've got what he's saying, a big sentence that we understand. If we don't, please stop. That's a question. A new one now. I always knew that Fred Crowe, who put together the original index to this book, and we've redone it again, but I always knew that it was a good index, but I really realized that when I looked up other things being equal, and it's in the index. And that's not the kind of thing that you'd expect to find in an index in a book, but sure enough, it's there. Okay, so number five, nor may we expect that events will generate their own definitions. That's the whole thing. There's no such thing as a pure happening. It's always something that happens. And here, this goes into cognitional theory. So this quote is one that is, again, expressing something that we covered last week, but I think this is something that's important to get. The answer yes to a question for reflection obtains a determinate meaning only by reverting from the yes to the question, from the yes to the question, and to its origin in the descriptive or explanatory answer to a question for intelligence. So yes by itself means nothing. It takes on a determinate meaning only when you revert from the yes to the question, is it true? And then determine, you revert from the it to the conjugates, the correlatives that you're talking about. Then yes takes on a meaning. So yes has a determinate meaning only by reverting from the yes to the question, from the question to the correlatives that the question is being asked about. So the event, the happening, the occurring corresponds to the bare yes. It happens. Later on, when we get into metaphysics, occurrence will be one type of act. Okay? There will be metaphysical elements. Anandam gives his own, will give his own understanding. It's quite original and yet quite in harmony with the best in the Aristotelian and Thomist tradition of the meanings of the words potency, form, and act. So, but act, one of the meanings of act is occurrence. It is, yes, it happens. Okay? But for that to have any meaning, there has to be something that happens, something form, correlatives. Does that make sense? Act is always the act of some intelligibility, the happening of some intelligibility, which metaphysically is referred to as form, and scientifically, or in this first part of the book, is the correlatives that are called conjugates. These are links now that I'm sort of anticipating when we move ahead into the metaphysics. All of this stuff is going to carry over. Empirical residue will be potency for form, and form happening, actually being verified, is act, it's occurring. So there's a metaphysics that is slowly, fictitiously being built there. As it goes along. So the event, the happening, the occurring corresponds to the bare yes. To say what happened, what occurs, one must raise a question that cannot be answered by a yes or no. One must appeal either to the experiential conjugates of description or to the pure conjugates of explanation. On this showing, then, one cannot expect events to generate their own definitions. There's always something that happens so often. It's not just the event, but what happens. What is the event? What's happening in the event? That's what happens so often. Any more than one can expect yes or no to settle what is affirmed or denied. And finally, if events cannot generate their own definitions, then frequencies of events cannot do so. There's always what is determined by the classical laws that happens every so often. There seems no reason to expect that different types of events must have different numerical frequencies, or indeed that the numerical frequencies could serve to specify the kinds of events to which one wishes to refer. When we get later on into metaphysics, this is going to be a way in which science gets to the distinction between form and act, or in the Thomist language, the science getting to the distinction of essence, form, and existence, act. The only reality that is its own existence is God. The rest of it is there's a distinction between the form and the act, what is and the is. So again, they're building towards metaphysical distinctions that will become clear in a metaphysical context later on, but establishing a continuity and bringing the meaning of the classical metaphysics forward into the scientific framework. Make sense? Next, a complementarity in modes of abstraction. In its first moment, the classical moment, inquiry aims at determining the systematic component in data. And in its second movement, inquiry turns to the more concrete task of determining the manner in which the systematic component moderates the non-systematic by setting ideal limits from which the non-systematic cannot diverge systematically. The complete view results only from the combination of the two, and so the two are complementary. Number 7, they're complementary in their verification. Roughly, that's expressed on page 134 as follows. Classical laws determine what would happen if conditions were fulfilled, while statistical laws determine how often one may expect conditions to be fulfilled. Or more fully, a few pages later, the determination, on the same page actually, excuse me, the determination of either classical or statistical laws leaves room for the determination of the other. Exact and complete knowledge of classical laws can merely leave room, not merely can leave room for possible statistical investigation, but also must do so. For such exact and complete knowledge would embrace all the systematic relations between determinate data. Nonetheless, such knowledge would be abstract, and so in need of further determinations to be applied to concrete instances. It follows that the further determinations cannot be systematically related to one another, and so there must be a field for statistical laws. Inversely, statistical laws are of no greater scientific significance than the definitions of the events whose frequencies they determine. Again, this relationship between the correlatives and the yes. Unless these definitions are determined scientifically in classical formulations, statistical thought lapses into pre-scientific insignificance. And finally, I think this is the last of the points. It's the last of the ways in which the knowing, the two forms of knowing are complementary. It's the one that Chris was pointing to earlier. The two types of laws are complementary in their domains of data. By this is meant not that some data are explained by classical laws and other data by statistical laws, but rather that certain aspects of all data receive the classical type of explanation. Everything comes under law. While other aspects of the same data are explained along statistical lines. So to account for data as similar classical laws is not to account for data in all their aspects. Each datum is just this instance of the given. So here we're seeing now the scientific significance of the empirical residue. Each datum is just this instance of the given. It emerges within a continuous manifold. It's in a particular place and at a particular time. It occurs rarely or frequently. Now these aspects of all data are disregarded in explanations of the classical type, which just explain the conjugates that are involved in whatever is happening, but not how often or why it happens here and doesn't happen there, and so on and so forth. Hence, explanations of the classical type have to be complemented by explanations of a further different type. Why is it that life has emerged only in very limited areas in the universe, for instance? Let's take that as a question, as an example, for an indication of the kind of thing that we're talking about here. Whether it's only on Earth or not, we don't know. But there it is not throughout the universe. We do know that. Why is that? Okay. Take it as life. The datum, all the data of life are just, let's go back to the top line there on page 3. All of these data of life are just these instances of the given. They emerge within a continuous manifold. Think of the whole universe. Within that universe, you've got this emergence at these particular places and these particular times, and only these, whatever, however many they are. They occur really rarely, given the whole entirety of the entire universe. These aspects of all data are disregarded in explanations of the classical type, which simply want to understand what is the immanent law of life, DNA and all of that sort of thing, okay? But not so much the question of the here and now and the why here and not there and so on and so forth. You've got to go into some kind of other explanation which include the classical but also the statistical in giving you that, and that's what we'll see when it goes into the emergent probability. To have later schemes can only emerge where earlier schemes have emerged and so on and so forth. Go back that way. So explanations of the classical type have to be complemented by explanations of a further different type. If certain chemical compositions have not occurred, then life cannot occur. And until they do occur, it's impossible for life to occur. If life has not occurred, consciousness cannot occur. So you've got to have life before consciousness, and so on. Statistical science would seem to be headed toward a statistical explanation of data in their numbers and in their spatio-temporal distribution. And ideally, if everything about everything were known, we would know that about the entire universe, and exactly why it is, and where it was that life first emerged, and why, and so on and so forth. Why are there, in the world of our experience, such vast numbers and such enormous intervals of time? Because probabilities are low, numbers have to be large. The probability of the emergence of life at the beginning of the universe was extremely low. The numbers have to be large. Because occasions are rare, time intervals have to be long. And long here means long. So statistical laws have a capacity to generate explanations. The incapacity for systematic divergence when combined with large numbers and long intervals of time is equivalent to a positive tendency to an intelligible order to an effective thrust that is no less explanatory than the rigorous conclusions based on classical laws. So let me pause there just to see whether or not we've got something. Does that example help of chemical and then life and then consciousness and so on. So later, it'll come up with in the next part too, but the later schemes can't emerge unless the earlier have emerged, and the later will occur in fewer places and so on and so forth. There'll be a restriction in the space. Sorry, what's your question? Okay. Probability, then, is one thing, and chance is another. Now, I'm going to make a couple of qualifications on what he says here, because what he's saying is correct, but I think it's just for us to be clear about it. Probability is an ideal norm that, for all its ideality, is concretely successful in the long run. So whatever the probability of life emerging anywhere was at the origin of the universe, it was concretely successful in the long run. Chance is merely the non-systematic divergence of actual frequencies from the ideal frequencies named probability. Chance explains nothing. That's true. It explains nothing, but it doesn't mean that it's not that the events themselves are not under law. And that's the one qualification that I wanted to make. That the non-systematic divergence from the probabilities is a residue from the probabilities, but the laws of laws of mechanics, for instance, or whatever the laws are still obtained in those happenings. It pertains irretrievably to the merely empirical residue, to the aspects of data from which intelligence always abstracts. Well, in this case, from the aspects from which statistical intelligence is abstracted. Probability is an intelligibility. It is, as it were, rescued from the merely empirical residue by the roundabout device in which inquiring intelligence sets up the heuristic anticipations of the statistical type of investigation.
There seems to be, I don't know, but maybe we'll just talk a little bit and maybe I'll be able to understand my own point here. But there seems, in probability, you have to be able to imagine that things might be other than the way they are. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be a fundamentally different kind of reasoning than the reasoning in classical laws. And that even that reasoning, even the probabilities, when we talk about the probability of life emerging, I mean, every 10 years or so, some new discoveries are made, and they recalculate all the probabilities.
Absolutely.
So, I guess I don't see, I can see how the two things could be complementary in terms of the way scientists proceed, but I don't see how the two things necessarily explain all there is to be explained.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't.
Well, there's a sense in which they, I mean, the book, as it proceeds, will argue that they don't explain all there is to be explained, because there's still the simple contingency or the facticity of any, why is there anything rather than nothing? And that's not explained by either of these laws.
Okay.
So, and that demands another explanation. Which he isn't taking up yet. He's presuming that there is something rather than nothing, and then he's trying to understand what is there about that something that there is. But these laws don't answer that other question of why there's anything rather than nothing at all.
Because once there is something,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, the whole assumption of probability is that you can imagine that something is other than it is, but it isn't. What is what was.
Yeah.
You could say, well, you know, I don't know exactly.
Well, okay, but even there, you know, in the next section he'll distinguish the actual series of schemes, the probable series of schemes, and the possible series of schemes.
Right.
So
right.
There is a distinction there, because the probable, I mean.
It still involves my imagination. To be able to come up with those categories, that involves my imagination.
Okay.
My imagination is subject to revision.
Okay.
So it's still a description of me and what I know. It's not a description of what's out there.
Well, okay. Oh, okay. but is the real then is what's out there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, for the empirical side.
So there's a cutoff between you and what's real. See, that's. Or why can there not be, if there's a complementarity in the knowing, why can there not be also a complementarity in the known? And then the further question arises, what's the ontological status of the known? Is it my imagination or my ideas, or is it the real? So in this chapter, he's not yet into that epistemological question. He's saying there's a complementarity in the knowing procedures.
Okay. Okay.
And if there's a complementarity in the knowing, there must be, as we'll see in the next section, a complementarity in the known, because the known
okay.
is correlative to the knowing.
Okay.
The further question of, well, what do I know? What is it? Is it just my ideas? Or is it being? That's a further question.
Okay.
We're not at that yet. We will be in chapter 12. There's an order in there. But I'm glad you're raising the issue. Because, yeah, I mean, at where he is in the book right now, he hasn't brought you any further than what you've just said.
Okay.
There's the complementarity in the knowing activities. And now there must be. If it's the knowing activities, there's got to be a complementarity in what they know. Because
right.
knowing and known are correlative. There's still the further question of what is it that is the known? Is the known the real? Or is the known the ideal? Or the whatever.
Okay.
And that's a further issue. That will come up later. It's into the second part of the book. What is it that I know when I do these things? Now he will say it's the real, but he's got that's another argument. But then it's a different argument that he needs to try to establish. It's a very good question. Pinpoints exactly where we are right now. He doesn't ask you to make a judgment about reality until chapter 11 in the book, about the real. It's just the complementarity in knowing, but you're not making any metaphysical or ontological statements yet, or claims or anything. I'm glad you raised that, because it clarifies just exactly where we are and what he's doing in the first part of the book. It's only what am I doing when I'm not. Okay, then, so we can move into number 10 here. It remains to settle a complementarity in what is to be known by these complementary cognitional procedures. So as I just said to, in response here, knowing and known, if they are not an identity, at least stand in some correspondence. And as the known is reached only through the knowing, the operations of knowing, the structural features of one are bound to be reflected in the other. Okay? And that, there's no other claim yet that he's making. He's not saying the known is the real. He's saying the known is the known. And the structural features of the knowing and the structural features of the known are bound to be, the term that he will use later on is isomorphic. They will have the same structure. In the terms in which he'll present it later on. This makes a lot of people nervous, but it's there's no need for that. I hope I can be able to say later on. But if knowing is experience, understanding, and judgment, if knowing is experience, understanding, and judgment, the known is going to be a compound of the experienced, the understood, and be judged, be affirmed. And that's all he's saying. In fact, he's not even dealing with this part of it yet. He's just dealing with these two here, the experienced and the understood. So if knowing is a matter of understanding experience, as far as operations go, then the known has to be the understood experienced. Okay? It has to be. The structure of one has to be reflected in the other. Right. That doesn't yet commit into any cognitional theory, idealism, realism, anything else. It's just saying that if the known is reached only through the knowing, then the structural features of the knowing are bound to be reflected in the structural features of what we know. If knowing is experience and understanding, a combination of those, then the known must be a combination of what is experienced and what is understood. In the next in chapters 9 and 10, he'll go on and add judgment, and so the knowing must be also judged. But the known must be something that is affirmed. But that's a further issue. So in general, then, number 11, the worldview that comes out of this will be concerned with the intelligibility imminent in the universe of our experience. What is the generic intelligibility of the universe of our experience. I'm going to say the universe of being, but that's a later issue. So the universe of our experience. For that is what empirical method is out to determine. And so this worldview will say nothing about the end or purpose of the universe, why it exists, the materials from which it was fashioned, the agent or agents responsible for it. That's not the point of the scientific investigation or the scientific worldview. Secondly, the account will be generic, resting solely on the dynamic structure of inquiring intelligence. And so it's not going to go into the specifics of the laws of chemistry, the laws of botany, the laws of biology. That's not for the physicist, for the philosopher to determine. That's for the physicist, the chemist, the botanist, the biologist, and so on. That's what they're about. They give you the specific laws. This is a generic overview, resting solely on the dynamic structure of inquiring intelligence. It will be relatively invariant. That is, it will be based in that invariant structure, but only in so far, it will be invariant only in so far as Lonergan's got that structure right. Okay, so relatively invariant, that is to say, based on the, insofar as I'm accounting for the structure in a way that will hold up. So it's relatively invariant. It's based in the invariant structure, but only as that structure is here accounted for. Okay? And fourthly, it will be incomplete at this point. It'll be rendered more complete by the consideration later of the notion of things. And finally, it does not claim to be deductive. It's not a priori. It takes a clue from the nature of insight, and it develops that clue and pushes it as far as it can go. So what is the worldview? Well, the clue has to do with schemes of recurrence. I'm going to start with some of the examples on 141 and 142, because I think if we've got some examples here. Schemes of recurrence, he gives the following examples at the bottom of the last paragraph on 141. In illustration of schemes of recurrence, the reader may think of the planetary system, of the circulation of water over the surface of the Earth, of the nitrogen cycle familiar to biologists, of the routines of animal life, of the repetitive economic rhythms of production and exchange. So those, just think of any one of those that would be the closest to your experience, and you'll get the notion of what he means by a scheme of recurrence. Probably for many of us, it would be the repetitive economic rhythms of production and exchange, where it's closer to an everyday experience. Or the planetary system is one that I think, well, we've used it already. So back to my notes then, number 12. On the one hand, the world of our experience is full of continuities, oscillations, rhythms, routines, alternations, circulations, regularities. Okay, the world is full of those things. On the other hand, the scheme of recurrence, the notion of the scheme of recurrence, not only squares with this broad fact, but also is related intimately both to classical and to statistical laws. For the notion of the scheme emerges in the very formulation of the canons of empirical life. Abstractly, a scheme of recurrence is a combination of classical laws. But concretely, schemes of recurrence begin, continue, and cease to function in accord with statistical probabilities. Such is our clue, our incipient insight. All right, what is a scheme of recurrence? Scheme of recurrence happens when a series of events, so these are events now, A, B, C, that series of events is so related that if A occurs, B occurs. If B occurs, C occurs. If C occurs, go as far as you want, all the way down to X occurs. If X occurs, A occurs. Starts over. And that just keeps going. A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, over and over. So, a scheme of recurrence. It's not just a linear kind of thing, but you get down to a certain point and it starts up again. The scheme could be such that none of the arrangements could function alone, yet all would function if they were conjoined in an interdependent combination. The scheme can be complemented by a defensive circle that would eliminate anything that would tend to upset the scheme. So think of economic rhythms of production and exchange. Economists or politicians or whatever, they can set up, they can anticipate difficulties in the production and exchange, and they can set up defensive circles to keep those from happening, whether justly or unjustly, but they can do that. And the same thing can happen in the pre-human or non-human. There is a scheme of recurrence then when you've got a series of events so related that the fulfillment of the conditions for each would be the occurrence of the others. If A occurs, B will occur. B occurs, C will occur, if C occurs, A will recur. The scheme, again, could be such that none of the arrangements could function alone, yet all of them would function if conjoined in an interdependent combination. So this is what you have, this is systematic. When you have schemes of recurrence happening, you've got systematic process. So he would say then that, for instance, our planetary system is a set of schemes of recurrence. A occurs, B occurs, B occurs, C occurs, and so on. It's a systematic process. But he says that emerged, it began to happen. It continues to happen all of these with a certain probability. And it could conceivably cease to function. So the schemes emerged with a certain probability. They continue with a much higher probability, because once they've emerged, the probability jumps. But they could cease to function. It's not impossible if they could cease to function. There's that kind of contingency about them. So, and then he says that the concern when you're looking for a worldview is not just with single schemes or even single types of schemes, but rather with a conditioned series of schemes. And this is where what I would want you, what I would ask you to consider is chemical, biological, and sensitive psychological schemes as a conditioned series of schemes. Now, this is on a broad, broad view. I'm not going into any scientific details because I'm not able to. But you've got to have certain chemical schemes functioning in certain ways before you can have any biological schemes emerging. Those others have got to be functioning first before the biological. And you've got to have the biological at a certain level of complexification before you can have sensitive consciousness emerging. So just take those three different types of schemes. You've got to have schemes of chemical combinations. And they've got to be in the right chemical, they've got to be in the right combinations and distributions for life to emerge. And then life has to evolve to a certain complexification before consciousness can emerge, sensitive consciousness. So those would be set, that would be an example of a conditioned series of schemes. The schemes, and now here the letters refer not to events as the ABC did before, but rather to three different sets of schemes. So let's consider P is chemical. P is chemical, Q is biological, R is sensitive consciousness. So the schemes P, Q, R form a conditioned series. If all prior members of the series must be functioning actually for any later member to become a concrete possibility. So all the appropriate chemical compositions and distributions must be actually functioning for life to emerge. All of the requisite biological compositions and distributions must be functioning for sensitive consciousness to emerge. So you've got a conditioned series. Conditioned. The condition of life is the chemical in a certain set of compositions and distributions. The condition of sensitive consciousness is life at a certain level of complexification. The actual seriation of schemes is unique. It consists of the schemes that actually were, are, and will be functioning in our universe, precisely specified as to places, durations, and relations to one another. The probable seriation is manifold. At each stage, there is a set of probable next stages, of which some are more probable than others. The probable seriation includes all that would occur without systematic divergence from the probabilities. And then the possible seriation includes all the schemes that could be devised from the classical laws of our universe, no matter how negligible their probability. So the actual will diverge from the probable, okay? Let's follow his wording here. The possible exhibits the greatest complexity and variety. It depends solely on a consideration of classical laws. It suffers from the indeterminacy of the abstract, and so exhibits the process of any universe with laws similar to ours. The probable seriation depends on statistical as well as classical laws, and indeed on the statistical laws that arise from the initial or basic situation of our world. Think of it as the Big Bang, or however you want to consider it. But with that, there's a certain probable seriation that came into existence. Still, if it's not as abstract as the possible seriation, nonetheless it is ideal. For each moment of world history, it assigns a most probable future course. But it also assigns a series of less probable courses, and it has to acknowledge that any of these may prove to be the fact. finally, the actual seriation is unique, but it purchases its uniqueness by going beyond the field of all laws, classical and statistical, and entering the field of observation, in which alone non-systematic divergences from probability are determined. There, too, those non-systematic divergences still come under law, so he's, I have to make that qualification, but they, the classical laws can still attend. Is that okay on that? Make sense, or are we lost? I can't tell. Yes?
Seriation is just the making of series?
It's the sequence of series. We got the sequence of the chemical, and then at a certain point, it's ready for life to emerge, and then at a certain point, life is ready for consciousness to emerge. A sequence of series is a series.
So, but then these are not really necessarily related to the schemes of recurrences of events, or it's just a model to show you that these are sequences of sequences.
Yes.
Right, because, I mean, obviously I'm not returning to the same place ever, and it's all just moving.
It's moving forward. Yeah. You're not returning to the same place.
Right.
You are.
Right.
You're setting up the conditions for moving on.
To the next. Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
And this goes into a little bit further, but what actually sets up the conditions, this will become clearer in the chapter on things, but what actually sets up the conditions for moving from this to this, for instance, will be found in the non-systematic divergences. That those non-systematic divergences become potency for the emergence of a higher form. That doesn't mean that they necessitate the emergence of the higher form. That's where your potentiality for the emergence of the more complex arises. That'll become clearer in the chapter six. So that it does all fit together.
Is that because the non-systematic divergences, is that because what the future schemes take over on the non-systematic divergences?
That's right. The future schemes systematize what was non-systematic. That's what happened.
Because if you just had a rehash of the systematic, then you wouldn't get out of the one that you have right now.
Conceivably, according to this worldview, there may have been many, many instances, single instances of life before schemes, living schemes emerged. Just hotbox legato, the Greek phrase, like a hotbox, it happens once, life, but then it ceases. It was a non-systematic divergence. But then you start getting non-systematic divergences that are starting to move more and more towards systems. When they've moved to our system, you've got schemes, and then you've got life. And then in the biological realm, you've got instances, perhaps, of consciousness, but they're just instances. But then all of a sudden they start happening in a way that is getting systematized. They start moving towards system. And then at that point, you've got, when you get into the chapter of things, we say you got an animal. Okay. But we're not at that point yet of talking about what kind of thing you're talking about. But you've got this is happening on a regular basis. You've got a scheme of consciousness. See? But who knows? We have no idea that before the first animal schemes emerged, how many single instances of life might there have been that just came into existence and went out of existence. You didn't have the schemes, but you have this and that. So, but then you get more of this and more of that with the big numbers and long periods of time. And and all of a sudden it starts working together. And you've got consciousness emerging as a scheme, not just as a one-time thing, but as a scheme. The same thing applies in the intellectual world of human beings. It's quite likely that a poem, at least according to some interpreters of ancient Egyptian literature, a poem by the pharaoh Ikhnaton expressed a metaphysical insight that is probably comparable to anything that you would find in Plato or Aristotle. This is at least the way some people interpret that. But it never took off because the conditions in the culture were not yet ready for that sort of thing to become a scheme in which at least some of the people could live and function. So it was a once kind of thing. It could, had it taken off, it could have perhaps pulled the culture out of its mythic framework and into realism, like the way Greek philosophy pulled the culture into realism. It was Plato and Aristotle, it was Socrates, those persistent questions, but somehow the conditions were, they were ready for that to happen. So you've got the same kind of thing, the same sorts of things in the explanation of the evolution of human consciousness itself, the movement towards systematic thinking. Movement, systematic thinking can only happen when other types of knowing are. Take Piaget's thing of the development of the child. And it's only certain forms of cognitive acts have to be happening schematically before other types of cognitive acts can emerge. And so the child becomes capable of formal operations on propositions only at a certain age. And it's only when the underlying habits are functioning schematically that this new type of habit formed. When did you raise your first speculative question? There had to be a lot of other cognitive development before you could raise a speculative question. Like, why is there something rather than nothing? Or how is it possible that God... My first speculative question was, you know, when we're taught God has no beginning and no end. Well, no end. Once it's in existence, I can understand how that's possible. How is it possible for anything to have no beginning? And that was the first question that was really a theoretical question, that at least that I can remember, and I was just stuck. But there had to be other things functioning before you can even raise a question. So that's this. What I'm saying is this goes across. It goes through. It cuts through everything. Some way, the notion, the generic notion of previous schemes, later schemes building on previous, and the possibility of one-time happenings not yet becoming systematized, remaining simply non-systematic divergences from the scheme, but then they start to become systematized and then you've got their schemes. Does that make sense? Okay. Paul?
What I don't see is the non-systematic is a necessary occurrence for the systematic.
Yeah.
Before you can go on.
Yeah.
And so it isn't, like, my understanding of the non-systematic was this idea of chance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something chances to happen, but it has to happen. It's not the case that it can't happen.
The systematic emerges out of the non-systematic. So, for instance, when you now we don't know in detail what the basic situation of the universe was. I mean, did it start out with some schemes right away? elementary physical atomic schemes right away. But the further schemes beyond those are a function of the non-systematic becoming systematic. All right, so that you've got you have the to come back to this is a very broad sort of picture of it. But life emerges because you've got divergences from non-living schemes that start to become regular.
But why don't you just say that the non-systematic is the beginning? weakening of another system or scheme?
It's the potency for another scheme. But it, as non-systematic, it's not yet the beginning of a new scheme. Okay? It becomes the beginning of a new scheme when it becomes systematic. Before that, it's just the potency for the emergence of the new scheme. I think we're saying the same thing. I think we're just...
The unexplainable then fits in with what we really call a phenomenon. A phenomenon, like something that can't be explained, doesn't fit in anywhere.
And there's something that can't be explained from the standpoint of the schemes that are already functioning. When you do the whole metaphysics of this book, everything has an explanation. Not that I'm necessarily ever going to get to, but every being is completely intelligent. God's the only one who has a rational. We might have a share in that with the vision of God, but being is completely. Is that part of what you're asking about?
Yeah.
Let's break. We're over time. I'm sorry. About 10 minutes or so.